listening to Unsound Methods on Yurt Radio at Hampshire College, and I am Damon Blanchett. On this show, I talk science news, skepticism, and I play some music. Each week, I choose a different theme for the music I play, and this week, it's four-letter bands. That is, bands with a name that has four letters in it. I started there with Rush, R-U-C-H, and their song YYZ. I gotta think that song was named after the Toronto International Airport, which has the airport code YYZ. And Rush actually happens to be from Canada, too. I wonder if they had an interesting interaction at the Toronto airport. Decided to write a very cool song about it. If you'd like to reach me, you can do that in nearly real time by sending a tweet to @DamonBlanchett, or you can send me an email at damonblah@gmail.com. I've decided on a small change to the format of the show this week. I'm going to highlight one specific story each week, and I'm going to call that my unsound method of the week. This week, we're starting with a pretty good one here. The first one is a doozy. Last week, an article was published in Newsweek, and that might be your first red flag there. Newsweek isn't exactly a scientific journal. It was written by a neurosurgeon, one Dr. Eben Alexander, who has claimed that he has proof of the existence of heaven. His evidence for this? Well, that would be his own near-death experience, which happened while he was in a coma from bacterial meningitis. He actually wrote an entire book about his experience, aptly titled Proof of Heaven. Now, I could go in a little bit on near-death experiences in general, but I'll go into what this guy had to say. Before I go into some details, though, I want to thank Dr. Stephen Novella for his excellent write-up about this, which is where I got a good amount of the information that I'm going to mention here, although I did hear about this from many various places on the internet. Dr. Novella's blog is called Neurologica, and it's really good. He also hosts a podcast that I love, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. So I'll start here. Here's a quote from Dr. Alexander, who, in his claim that heaven exists, and I quote, "There is no scientific explanation for the fact that while my body lay in coma, my mind, my conscious inner self, was alive and well. While the neurons of my cortex were stunned to complete inactivity by the bacteria that had attacked them, my brain-free consciousness journeyed to another larger dimension of the universe, a dimension I never dreamed existed and which the old pre-coma me would have been more than happy to explain was a simple impossibility." End quote. First thing that came to my head after I read this was, wait a second, how does he know that when he was having these visions of heaven, that it was during the time that his brain showed no outside physical activity? How does he know when he was basically brain dead, when his neurons were not firing, that's when he had these visions? People... The thing is here is people don't just drop into a coma or come out of one instantly. It can take an entire day. It can certainly at least take hours, especially when you're having problems such as something like bacterial meningitis. But really, a coma is not something you instantly go into, or at least not that you instantly come out of. Different parts of the brain start up and shut down, usually probably in what's going to be a random order. You never know what is going to start up first or second or how it's going to go. How does this Dr. Alexander know that when he had these visions, he wasn't either on his way into the coma or on his way back out of it again, regardless of what he saw? He doesn't, and that one fact basically destroys his entire argument and that book that he wrote, in fact. He very easily could have been dreaming in the same way all of everybody else does every night. I'm not sure how he took what he saw and decided that this was evidence or proof of any way to heaven. It just doesn't make sense to me. I got a good quote from Dr. Novella here. the guy who wrote the good article about looking at the skeptical side of this. And I quote, "Documented features of these altered states, and features commonly experienced by everyone during dreams, include a sense of oneness with the universe, a sense of the profound, of being in the presence of a godlike figure, and of automatic knowledge with absolute certainty. The latter is not uncommon during dreams. You just know things in your dreams that were not communicated or directly observed, and you have no doubt about that knowledge." End quote. Dr. Alexander, who had this experience, says himself that it took him months to come to terms with his experience. His story is just, it's really just his waking brain trying to make sense of what he thinks he saw when he was in a coma. I mean, how much do you remember dreams, especially months after you have them? I can barely remember a dream I had last week. And if I tried, I'm sure half of it would be made up at the moment I'm trying to think of it. Trying to fill in the spaces, things that I couldn't remember, or maybe that didn't even happen in the first place. I'm not saying heaven isn't real, but I am saying that this is far, very far from evidence for it. That's for sure. And that is this week's Unsound Method. Up next, I've got a song from the band Korn. One of their older ones, one of my favorites by these guys. I haven't listened to them actually in quite a while, but pulling out this song brought some memories back, that's for sure. So here's Got the Life by Korn. All right, I'm back. That was Got the Life by Korn. Four-letter band. All right, for my next science news, I'm going to actually stay with the brain. A little bit more neurology news here. It was a good week. This one is really interesting, and it's actually something I've thought about in the past. I've tried to write a little bit of some fiction story, some sci-fi, and this story is actually very similar to something I've totally thought of. Let's see, the Human Brain Project, run by a collaboration of science organizations from all over Europe, is on a mission to simulate a working human brain inside a computer. This means all the neurons, all the connections, all the intricacies of the human brain simulated inside of a computer. The possibilities are endless if this were ever successful. Diseases such as that attack the brain would be able to be studied far more quickly and efficiently, helping us to eradicate conditions such as depression, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. This project here, called the Human Brain Project, is an extension of the already running, since 2005 that is, project called the Blue Brain Project, which set out originally to simulate in a computer the workings of the rat brain, neocortex. The team working on the Blue Brain Project, that's the rat one, announced last month that they were successful in mapping out the complex electrical brain circuitry through which thoughts travel inside of a rat brain. They know they were correct because their model accurately predicted the location of synapses in the rat cortex. Now, right here, this is one measure of scientific accuracy. If your model can predict things, it is at least on the way to being correct in the reality in which we live. And that's science. Trying to make predictions about the world, about the universe, really. And if your predictions end up coming true, you know you're at least on the way to being right. Now, the Blue Brain Project, again, the one with the rat brain neocortex, can be seen, according to the researchers, as a proof of concept, with the human brain as the ultimate goal. The scientists and organizations involved with the Human Brain Project have bid to the tune of $1.3 billion over the next 10 years to develop their hardware and software to simulate a full human brain, that is. The final goal is to have a working human brain in a computer, allowing scientists to perform experiments without having to open up somebody's skull. In addition, all the amazing neuroscience research currently in various locations and publications and computers all over the world that has been performed over the past couple of decades will have a single final location to go, allowing all of these scientists to, in essence, connect the pieces together. So the people who do the research on maybe some of the front of the brain and the people who do research on parts of the back of the brain or in other locations or in other fields will actually have one place that they'll be able to connect all of their data together in one place. This research, it would be amazing, actually, to be able to do this, to connect it all together. Our understanding of how the human brain works would jump in a massive way if we were able to simulate it accurately inside of a computer. You could even test drugs and do things like that without ever having to give them to people if you had a working model of the brain. Of course, it's not all super excitement here. There are some pretty big problems to figure out before it's even possible. It's not even possible at this point. One of the biggest problems is that the incredible hardware, the computing power required to be able to do something like this is beyond what we have right now. Way beyond, in fact. Just one of the 10,000 neurons in the rat brain required the computing power of one laptop. So one laptop is enough to compute whatever one neuron does. And so in order to do the rat neocortex, which they succeeded, they needed the power of 10,000 laptops, which is not too bad. This is something we can do these days. It's been done, obviously. However, a fully functioning human brain would require billions of laptops. Not 10,000, billions. Henry Markram, who's the leading scientist for the Blue Brain Project, said the computational power needed for a human brain will be available by the end of the next decade. I sure hope so. The article also said they were actually working with supercomputer hardware manufacturers, to push the technology along. And that's part of where this money is going to go, is just research and development of new technology in order to be able to make this project happen. Personally, I think the $1.3 billion these scientists are bidding for is money very well spent. The project not only has the potential to save millions upon millions of people suffering, the millions and millions of people suffering from brain conditions all over the world, but also just the process of building the human brain project would stimulate, like I was just saying, stimulate computer software and hardware development in untold ways. The software doesn't exist, although I'm willing to bet the software is closer than the hardware, especially if they were already able to do the rat neocortex in that Blue Brain project. I'm hoping this goes ahead. It was kind of funny in the article, people on the outside were saying that, what are they doing? They're creating Skynet, the computer in Terminator that turned on everybody. It's really not like that, though. This is not going to be a living thing. It will simply be, it's a computer software. You give it input, something else comes out. And if you could simulate something like one part of the brain, if you had the entire brain in the computer and you had one part of it, maybe you could simulate that one part shut down, then you could actually see what happens to the rest of the brain and how how vision or hearing changes, depending on what you do. Or if you knew how a drug affected the brain, you could write a program to simulate the drug and how it would affect the brain, and then see what would happen. It would speed up brain and neurology research massively, and just in a massive way. I wonder if Google has the computing power required for this. I was just looking, just before coming down here, Google's blog, thanks to Sarah, who I work with, I saw on Google's blog that they posted a short video, and you can actually do a street view of one of their data centers. And this is just one data center, and you can actually, like, as if you're going inside, you can see panoramic pictures of everything, and the place is just massive. It's unbelievably massive. And that's just one. Google has data centers all over the world. I'll bet if Google got involved in this, they could move it forward a little bit quicker than 10 years. 10 years is the projected time it'll take to simulate an entire human brain in a computer. I'm a bit skeptical about that. In my story, the one I was writing, I had it like 50 or 60 years from now before they actually figured it out. After reading this, I'm thinking maybe it's not going to be that long. I don't know about 10 years, but I'm going to guess more than 10 and less than 30. It's going to be cool. All right. And with that, I'm gonna play a song from another four-letter band. This one, ABBA, ABBA. This is their song, "Take a Chance on Me."
If you got no place to go when you're feeling down.
That was Take a Chance on Me by ABBA. ABBA or ABBA. All right, astronomy. I should make a segment of the show just for astronomy, I'd say. These people are constantly coming up with just new and awesome stuff all the time. Did you know that we have actually landed a probe on Saturn's moon, Titan? Did you know that Titan is actually larger than Mercury? That's and 50% larger than Earth's moon. And if it wasn't traveling around Saturn, but instead traveling around the Sun, Titan would actually be a planet. That's how big it is. Not only all that, but Titan actually has an atmosphere and liquids on its surface. It doesn't have water, unfortunately, since it's too liquid water, that is, since it's too cold. But it does have methane and ethane ponds and lakes all over the surface. It's also rocky. It's got weather. It's got sand dunes and a lot of surface features that are very much like the Earth. Titan is quite a moon. There's also a large amount of water ice on the little world. Anyway, besides how awesome Titan is, the recent news is that the probe named Huygens, after the discoverer of the moon, that did land back in 2005, that's when this happened. The researchers went back through the data by the sensors, and they figured out more about the actual landing. According to a recently published paper in Planetary and Space Science, the probe hit the ground on Titan, and then it skidded a bit, which revealed a bit about the surface, which is that at least where the probe landed, it was sort of a wet, sandy consistency, probably like landing on the beach on Earth. And then it hit a small rock. The probe and its partner, Cassini, which is currently orbiting Saturn and sending back some really amazing photos. If you do get a chance, go online and look for Cassini, because some of the images of Saturn that satellite sends back are just astounding. They found that the surface of Titan is actually very similar to proposals for what the early primordial Earth was like. The Huygens probe was not specifically equipped to search for life or organic compounds, but its sensors did give a good picture of what it's like at the surface. And according to scientists, the proposed atmosphere of the early Earth was very much like how the atmosphere of Titan is right now. But with one important exception, and that would be the lack of water vapor, thanks to the extremely cold temperatures. Being that far away from the sun, it's going to be pretty cold. Even if you could live on Titan, and you could see through the clouds and see Saturn right up there, how amazing would it be to have this huge planet with rings going around it up in the sky all the time? For one thing. Also, from that distance, the sun would just look like any other star in the sky. Probably the brightest one, but it would just look like any other star, just a point, which is pretty amazing. And that's inside our own solar system. Still, going back to what I was saying, the possibility exists that microbial extraterrestrial life exists on this moon, on Titan. How cool is that? It's possible that the life uses methane or ethane on the surface, which is what is liquid on the surface, just like life on Earth uses water. Life on Earth requires water. If there were no water here, there would be no life. But it is possible that life can exist without water. It just needs another liquid, another solvent, in order to have biological processes take place. It's never been proven, at least not yet, but the atmospheric composition of Titan is actually what it might be if methanogenic life existed on the moon. So basically what I'm saying is that if life did exist and on Titan and used methane or ethane in order to survive, in order to do biological processes, then it would leave a certain signature in the atmosphere of Titan, just due to processes, respiration and things like that. The atmosphere would change if life was present, and it's not proven, but the atmosphere of Titan actually looks like this. It looks like there might be life possible. I hope NASA can get some funding, enough funding to send another probe back out to Titan, back out to Saturn, in order to do this research, to look for life specifically. It would be amazing. Very cool. All right. I'm going to play another song right now. This time it is Styx is the band. Yes, four letters again. And this song is Renegade, which I'm sure many of you have heard.
I'm so far from my home. Oh, mama, I can hear you crying. You're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.
That was Renegade by the band Styx. S-T-Y-X, that's right, still four letters. So how many out there felt that earthquake yesterday evening? I sure didn't, although the dog barked a couple times for no reason, which was kind of weird. And next thing I know, I go to Twitter, and I'm seeing some posts about an earthquake. It turns out something like a 4.0 magnitude earthquake hit southern Maine last night around 7:12 p.m. The epicenter was about 20 miles west of Portland, and it was 3 miles underground. According to reports that I read, the shaking was felt as far down as here, right here in Massachusetts, of course. A bunch of people at work today said they felt it. Some people didn't, some people did. Like I said, I didn't feel anything, but then again, I live way up in the hills. Maybe it would probably take a pretty big one to get through all of that rock. I did one time feel an earthquake, and that was that big one last year, the one in Virginia. It happened in Virginia, and I actually had to look this up because I didn't remember when it was. It was on August 23rd of last year, over a year ago. That one was a magnitude 5.8 with an epicenter in Virginia. Now, the difference between a 4.0 and a 5.8 is actually more than you might think. It's a logarithmic scale, which means it's one number higher, but I believe it's actually 10 times more powerful when you go from 4 to 5. So the number rises very quickly. If you get a high number, 5, 6, 7, 7 is going to be insanely powerful compared to a 5, which is going to be a bunch more powerful than a 4. When that one happened, the 5.8 in Virginia, I was actually in my office at work. Back then I worked at Smith. I was in a basement. I was sitting there at my desk, and suddenly it was almost like I got dizzy, like my whole body kind of shifted forward and then back again. It was really weird. I thought it was trucks driving by outside making vibrations or something. I didn't know what had happened. And then same thing. Facebook and Twitter started lighting up with reports of an earthquake, and that's how I found out what it was. That was the only earthquake I've ever felt, though. It was interesting. I did a little bit of research on this. Well, just to get some science into it here, I did some research. It turns out there have been a few large earthquakes here on the East Coast. Maybe I should put large in quotes because it's nothing like they have out on the West Coast, but we get them out here too. Let's see, a few of them. Way back on November 18th, 1755, there was a rather large one that hit Cape Ann, Massachusetts. That one was estimated to be about a 6.0, which is pretty strong. They say cracks story. It was 1755, so they're going by stories and whatever people wrote in books, newspapers, possibly newspapers too. Definitely newspapers back then. They say cracks literally opened up in the earth near Boston. Shaking in the ground was felt all the way from Nova Scotia to Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. That's a pretty good size one, but it's not the biggest one ever. The largest earthquake ever measured on the east coast of the U.S. occurred in Charleston, South Carolina in 1886. This one registered as a 7.3. Now, this is enough to do some major damage. 7.3 is really powerful. It was bad enough where train tracks were bent and nearly every structure near the epicenter was damaged. That earthquake was felt as far away as Boston. That's hundreds and hundreds of miles. It was an earthquake in Charleston, South Carolina, felt all the way in Boston. Incredible. You'd think the West Coast, like with its big faults like San Andreas, the only place where earthquakes might happen, but they really do happen out here, as evidenced by what happened last night, and also these past earthquakes. It's much more rare here since we're not on a fault line, but it does happen. They're also usually less intense. Maybe that's a good thing. No need to get earthquake insurance around here, but it happens. All right, I'm going to play another song, and then I got one more science news report. It's actually a pretty interesting one about sleep. So here you go. This is Muse, Knights of Cydonia.
We'll be right back.
That was Knights of Cydonia by Muse. Yes, four letters. Awesome song. That song has some great lyrics in it. One of them really gets me. Don't waste your time or time will waste you. So true, Muse. So true. So how do you sleep at night? Getting the most hours you can? I hope so, because according to the latest study, not getting a good night's sleep will actually make you fatter. So not only will depriving yourself of sleep make you cranky and unable to use your brain, which I'm sure all of us have discovered in some way, but it also messes up your fat cells and makes you more likely to get things like diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, that is. This happens because lack of sleep increases levels of a hunger hormone and reduces levels of a fullness hormone, possibly leading you straight towards overeating and weight gain, and all of the problems that that brings with it. According to researchers at the University of Chicago, not getting enough sleep reduces your fat cells' ability to respond properly to the hormone insulin, which is critical for regulating energy storage and use. A quote from Matthew Brady, one of the study's authors, and I quote, "Our fat cells need sleep to function properly. If you're sleep deprived, your brain may feel groggy, but it also turns out your fat cells also need sleep, or they are metabolically groggy." The findings, which are being published this week in the Annals of Internal Medicine, show that after four nights of sleep deprivation, the body's ability to respond to insulin properly decreased by 16%, which they said paves the way for type 2 diabetes. In addition, the fat cell's ability to use insulin actually decreased by 30%, meaning fats actually start circulating in the blood, which also increases the likelihood of health problems. So, lack of sleep. Not good, not good. Possibly one of the reasons we're having an obesity problem here in this country. We'll see. I think we need a little bit more research on this one. It's certainly interesting findings, but they only did the study on, I think it was either 7 or 8 people, which is not a very large study. Hopefully somebody very soon will actually try to replicate these results, and we'll see if they get the same. I would bet they will, but good to keep track of this stuff. Lack of sleep is definitely a massive problem in this, probably all over the world, but I'm sure in America maybe more than other places. And if it not only messes up your brain, but also makes you fat and increases your risk of all these other diseases, then I think I may be doing more sleep. All right, I'd like to thank you for listening to Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio. My name is Damon Blanchett. I'm here every week from 5 to 6. You can reach me on Twitter at Damon Blanchett or by email at damonblah, that's D-A-M-O-N-B-L-A @gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook. I'm probably the only Damon Blanchett on Facebook, although I have not tried searching for myself, so I'm not sure. And to finish it today, we've got one of my favorite bands, probably my favorite rock band, favorite metal band, Tool. That's right, four letters, doing their song 46 and 2. I hope the rest of your week goes well, and I will be here next week. Have a good night. We'll be right back.
This is Neil Young from Hampshire College Media Services. You are listening to Yurt Radio.
The After Night Delight on Yurt Radio
with
Sal and Lisa.